threatened to put me out of business. And I've poured colossal amounts of time and energy into projects that fell short of expectations or died on the vine. I've learned, however, that the more of yourself that you're willing to sacrifice to your cause, the less perfect you have to be to succeed. You just have to get enough right enough of the time. So, you want a beautiful body, you say? That's nice, but what are you willing to sacrifice for it? Are you willing to hit the gym every day instead of watching TV? Are you willing to stop eating so much of the wrong foods you love so much? Are you willing to give every workout everything you've got? In other words, do you have the discipline to sacrifice the things you want to do for the things you know you should do? If you can't answer these questions with bloodless determination, then you don't really want it, and until you can, you'll never get it. Remember, nothing fails as spectacularly as half measures. Our culture seems to have forgotten this fundamental law of living. Instead, too many of us believe that life should be predominantly pleasurable, so we constantly search for ways to escape physical and psychological pain. Even our self-help books speak in soft, flattering tones, reassuring us that we're just fine the way we are, and that with enough positive thinking and self-talk, the universe will reward us with abundance and bliss. This is in stark contrast to times of old, when sacrifice was a sacred act that delighted the gods and earned blessings in return, whether in the form of plentiful harvests, success in war, or personal absolution. In Japan, for example, it was believed that sacrificing a woman at a rushing river would satisfy the spirit who lived there, allowing for the construction of bridges and the safe passage of boats. In the Bible, God sacrificed his only son for the sins of mankind. In Greek myth, Agamemnon killed his own daughter in exchange for a favorable wind on the way to Troy. The great civilizations of Mesoamerica killed people, smashed food, and sank treasure to pay their debts to their gods. Modernity looks upon such practices and stories as superstitious relics of our barbaric past, and while I wouldn't argue that we should slit a sheep's throat with next January's New Year's resolutions, what do you think might happen if we did? How much more seriously might you take those vows if you had to spill blood over them? And how might society change if everyone else had to do the same? My point is, we have been watching people succeed and fail for thousands of years, and in distilling and codifying our findings and observations, we've learned an important lesson. The people who win make the right sacrifices, and the people who lose don't. That's an unforgiving and unpalatable idea, but also powerful and empowering, because it says that there's no telling what you might be able to do if you're willing to pay the full price. It's also a warning. Life is fraught with peril and suffering, and there are innumerable ways to court chaos and reap the whirlwind. If we want to steer clear of as much catastrophe as possible, then we'd better get serious about making the proper sacrifices now, lest we find ourselves forced to make much harder sacrifices later down the line. What kind of sacrifices should we be making, you might be wondering? We could start with the obvious. We could stop doing things we know we shouldn't be doing, the things that, if stopped, would immediately make our lives better. You know, things like eating too much sugar or fast food, drinking too much alcohol or doing too much recreational drugs, spending too much time watching TV, playing video games, and using social media, and spending too much money on things we don't really need. Whatever your list is, and we all have one, take a moment to try to imagine how your life might change over the next year if you were to sacrifice these malignant parts of you. Now try to imagine what that future might look like if you were to also make the sacrifices of time, attention, and energy necessary to do the things you know you should be doing. Eating healthy, exercising regularly, working harder, educating yourself, budgeting and saving money, whatever they might be. What might happen if you were to do all of that? To what heights might you rise? When I self-published a little book called Bigger, Leaner, Stronger in 2012, I had no expectations or grand plans. I had no idea that it would or even could go on to sell over 350,000 copies and counting, making it one of the best-selling self-published fitness books of all time, and that I would then go on to write several other best-selling books that would together sell over 1 million copies, and then assemble a team of people and create a multi-million dollar family of companies, including traditional and digital publishing, nutritional supplements, personal coaching, software, and more. All I knew is writing that first book seemed like something I should do, and so I did it. Each successive development in my career has been guided by the same philosophy and intuition. Once I have committed myself to a desirable outcome, I then try to spend as much time as I can doing things I know will help me get there, and as little time as I can doing things I know will get in the way. This perspective on sacrifice has abundant support in the scientific literature as well. The classic example is the marshmallow test that's now synonymous with temptation, willpower, and grit. This research began in the 1960s at Stanford University, where Walter Mischel taught psychology. Mischel and his graduate students conducted an experiment wherein children were seated in a room and given the choice of their favorite treat, such as a marshmallow, mint, or pretzel, with the option to have one now or two later. The colleague then left the child in the room alone with the goodie and told him to speak up if he couldn't wait any longer, and the research team then secretly observed the children to see how they'd handle themselves. Naturally, many ate the treats straight away, others waited a bit and then gave in, but some managed to hold out until the scientists returned, usually by distracting themselves through singing, playing with their chairs, and other similar activities. Years later, Mischel and his team followed up with the children and found that those who had successfully waited for the second treat were faring markedly better in life than those who hadn't. They had better SAT scores, education levels, body mass indexes, and personal relationships, and they also rated higher in various life measures, including persistence, creativity, foresight, and others. These studies have since been criticized as inadequate for supporting some of the more sweeping conclusions drawn from them, but I believe the takeaway rings true. The willingness to sacrifice immediate gratification for future rewards is highly correlated with the ability to create a better life. What most stands in our way of being able to do this, though? Most people would say they just lack the willpower or self-control, but it's not that simple. While our ability to tap into willpower and exert self-control is influenced by our genetics and upbringing, it's not an immutable element of our biology. We can influence these things greatly through our choices, our mindsets, decisions, and environments. For example, if we choose to believe that our capacity for self-control is limitless, we'll be far better at regulating our behavior than if we choose to believe it's finite. This has been illustrated in a number of studies, including one conducted by scientists at the University of Maastricht that gave participants a challenge of controlling their facial expressions when shown upsetting video clips. One group of participants was told that the exercise would be energizing, while the other was told that it would be draining. And after viewing the videos, all participants squeezed a hand grip as hard as they could. The result? The former group performed noticeably better. Research conducted by scientists at Stanford University echoed these findings, demonstrating that students who believed that tough mental exertion didn't deplete their mental energy, didn't show diminished levels of self-control after strenuous experiences, and performed much better on their final exams. Students who believed that willpower is a limited resource, however, reported eating more unhealthy food, procrastinating more, and struggling more to prepare for their tests. Studies also show that we can enhance our self-control by avoiding situations where we have to actively resist temptation. For instance, if you want to go to a party and drink less, you can choose to sit far from where drinks are being served. Or if you're dieting and you don't want to eat too much while at a restaurant, you can ask the waiter to not bring the dessert menu or cart. And if you want to focus on studying or working without being distracted by your phone, you can put it on silent and leave it in another room. While tactics like these are well and good, chances are none of them are particularly striking to you. We instinctively know that if we were truly pushed to the wall, we probably wouldn't choose to die on any of the molehills that we struggle to climb every day. What is it then? What's really holding us back? For many people, it's the fact that it's easy to sacrifice uncertain future rewards for certain immediate ones. Stated differently, it's hard to sacrifice the certain for the uncertain. That's why we want to savor the junk food today rather than sacrifice it in hopes of a healthier tomorrow. Choose the warm embrace of the couch over the austerity of the gym, and consume mindless media instead of meaningful literature. This tendency to discount future gains is in our nature at least partly because our ancient ancestors had to obsessively chase immediate rewards just to survive. To them, a carrot you had to work years or even decades for was literally unthinkable. To make matters worse, what do these people do when they finally come face to face with the rotten orchards of their misbegotten desires? Do they reflect on all of their lousy decisions that have made them losers? Rarely. Instead, they whine about how hard and unfair it all is, the rules, competition, and outcomes, and begrudge others their wins. In his penetrating 2017 memoir cum compendium Principles, billionaire and hedge fund legend Ray Dalio said the following. In order to have the best life possible, you must, one, know what the best decisions are, and two, have the courage to make them. I don't know of any better way to do number one than to analyze the decisions we make every day and ask ourselves what games we're playing and how well we're playing them, and adjusting our investments of time, attention, and effort accordingly. This approach is uncomfortable because it requires self-awareness, honesty, knowledge, foresight, and discipline. But we can learn to appreciate and even enjoy the process because of the rewards it provides. In fact, if we can stay the course, this almost happens automatically because regardless of how foreign it might feel at first, the more we do something, the more we come to like it and want to continue doing it. Evidence of this can be found in seminal research conducted by Robert B. Zients and published in 1968 that demonstrated that mere exposure to an arbitrary stimulus generates mild affection for it. This holds true with nonsense phrases, human faces, Chinese ideographs, and other visual stimuli, as well as sounds, tastes, ideas, and social interactions of all kinds. Marketers and politicians have known the power of repeated exposure for at least as long, and it explains why they spend vast sums of money to repeat simple slogans, jingles, and messages again and again. They know that the more you see and hear their statements, the more familiar and acceptable their products, services, and ideas will become to you. This is why Geico spends over $1 billion per year creating and propagating silly but memorable commercials that have little to do with the benefits of insurance, and why political parties are so adamant that their members stay on message, repeating these same talking points as publicly and frequently as possible. What this means for our discussion is that while sacrificing immediate gratification may be difficult and awkward at first, the more we do it, the easier it becomes. It's just a habit that we can establish like any other, and as such, it can take some time to settle into. Specifically, studies show that new habits can take anywhere from a couple weeks to a couple months or longer to stick, with most people needing about 66 days to internalize new behavior patterns. The key then is making it through the first 2 months, and there are several psychological tricks we can employ to increase our chances of success. One way to deal effectively with temptation to act against your long-term interests is to view the choice as giving up the long-term reward for whatever you find immediately enticing. Take a moment to imagine what it would feel like to enjoy the ultimate payoff and bask in the fruits of your self-control. Then ask if you're willing to throw all that away for the fleeting pleasure of whatever form of instant gratification you're faced with. How does that trade make you feel? Is it worth it? Let's say you're on a quest to lose 15 pounds and are staring down a plate of your favorite confections. Close your eyes for a minute and imagine having reached your goal weight. Feel how your clothes fit, picture how your new body looks in the mirror, and hear the compliments from friends and loved ones. Now open your eyes and ask yourself, do you want that or the temporary delight of a dollop of sugar and fat? Chances are the desserts will look a lot less appetizing. This line of thinking not only helps us negotiate moments of temptation, it also highlights the fact that every transgression has real-world ramifications. The penalties are rarely obvious or immediately felt, however. They accrue insidiously like a growing thunderhead until a predestined moment in the future when they will unleash their pent-up fury upon us. Here is the smoker who receives the soul-shattering diagnosis, the glutton whose heart gives out, the cheater racked by guilt, and the ne'er-do-well devoid of self-respect. Similarly, every time we act nobly, tangible benefits may not materialize before our eyes, but they too accrue, inevitably manifesting in all manner of ways. There is always an immediate payoff in doing right by you, however, and it's the emotional reward of feeling good about your choices. Sophisticated marketers exploit this psychology with a technique known as laddering, which boils down to persuading people that buying a product or service will immediately make them feel the way they would like to feel. For example, to sell faster processing speed on a mobile device, it might go like this. A faster processor means less waiting. Less waiting means accomplishing more, and accomplishing more means feeling more in charge and powerful. Advertisements, then, would be aimed at convincing you that the minute you buy the faster phone, you'll enjoy the immediate, certain, and emotional reward of feeling commanding. We can use this psychological tactic to our advantage because while the concrete rewards of making good decisions may be delayed and uncertain, the emotional ones are always instantaneous and assured. By focusing on the latter, we can gain considerable power over our behavior. We can consider how it will feel to smoke or drink less or stick to our diet or exercise routine instead of how it will benefit our physiology. How it will feel to see our savings rise or debts fall instead of how it will impact our net worth or financial resilience. How it will feel to spend less time on social media or watching TV instead of how it will free up time for other valuable activities. Yet another method of short-circuiting a momentary desire is putting whatever is tempting you out of sight. This works because not being able to see the immediate reward makes it less exciting to our primitive selves and thus easier to reject. For example, one study conducted by scientists at the University of Illinois found that office workers who kept a jar of candy inside their desk drawer consumed considerably less than those who kept it on their desks. It's not harder to reach into a drawer than across a desk, but putting the goodies out of sight helped put them out of mind. Similar results were seen in another study conducted by scientists at the University of Cambridge. In this case, participants were told they were part of a relaxation and personality exercise and were placed in a room with a few magazines and a bowl of candy for 10 minutes. For one group of participants, the bowl was very close, about 20 centimeters away, and for the other, a little farther, about 70 centimeters away. Researchers found that the people who were 70 centimeters away from the candy ate on average 40% less than those who were closer. In another variation of the same study, the participants were exposed to the same situation and then given a memorization problem to solve to induce mental fatigue, and then re-exposed to the conditions. The outcome was the same, indicating that the reduction in candy eating wasn't a matter of cognitive effort required to reach for it, but mere proximity. You can also institute a mandatory 10-minute wait before allowing yourself to indulge in an undesirable activity. This may not seem like much time, but research conducted by scientists at Princeton University shows that it can make a big difference in how you perceive the situation. In short, the part of you that wants immediate gratification wants it now. And if you resolve to delay for just 10 minutes, it no longer sees an instant reward but a future one, allowing you to cool off and make the wiser choice. So, in the case of the showdown with desserts discussed earlier, if 10 minutes of waiting and visualizing the long-term reward at stake isn't enough to squash the desire to indulge, then allow yourself to, but not before. Flip this around, and you have a powerful strategy for fighting procrastination. Decide to do whatever you're dreading for just 10 minutes, and once they're up, allow yourself to stop. Chances are you'll want to keep going. Yet another highly effective strategy for training your willpower is called pre-commitment, which entails taking action now to strengthen your position and commitment to a behavior and ward off any underhanded attempts at self-sabotage. Much like how Ulysses instructed his men to lash him to the mast of their ship to ensure he didn't fall prey to the beautiful songs of the sea sirens, you too can create systems to protect you from your lower self. With the right pre-commitment strategies, you can put safeguards in place that make it nearly impossible to fail. For instance, if you have trouble with procrastinating on the internet instead of working, you can download a program called Cold Turkey, www.getcoldturkey.com, that allows you to block specific websites and applications or turn your internet off altogether for a set period of time. If sticking to a diet is your struggle, you could pre-commit by throwing out all tempting junk foods in the house and not rebuying them, preparing healthy lunches to bring to work every day, and putting money on the line on a website like www.dietbet.com. If you want to pre-commit to exercising regularly, you could pay for an annual membership of your gym instead of going month to month, or sign up for an online coaching service. Another tool that has helped many thousands of people pre-commit successfully to all kinds of goals is the website www.stickk.com. Stick allows you to set a goal in time frame, wager money, and decide what happens with it if you fail. It could go to a charity, for example, or even an organization you don't like, which can be a stronger incentive. You can also designate a referee who will monitor your progress and confirm the truthfulness of your reports and invite supporters to cheer you on. So remember this. Every moment of every day, we're making sacrifices of time, energy, and attention. Are they the right sacrifices, though? The sacrifices that accrue rewards instead of retributions? The sacrifices needed to make things better? Are we moving past listlessness and cravings for ease and comfort and developing the discipline to focus our minds and efforts on future benefits? Or are we still acting like children succumbing to our short-sighted primitive instincts? Are we making the right bargains with the future or selling ourselves short? These are some of the fundamental questions that we must reflect on regularly, and the body and life that we ultimately create will be our answers. I interviewed author and former Navy SEAL Mark Devine on my podcast a couple years ago, and he shared his experience of the infamous Hell Week that recruits have to survive, literally, to advance to the next round of training and selection. This ordeal was designed with one purpose in mind, to break people in body, mind, and spirit. And after the first few days, Mark feared he wasn't going to make it. Nothing could have prepared him for the nightmarish conditions, which included extreme sleep deprivation, relentless running, rowing, and rolling in the frigid shores of Coronado, California, and merciless hectoring from drill instructors whose job was to cull the weak from the herd. All he had to do, his superiors reminded him every hour, was ring a bell on the beach and all the agony would end. Salvation was always at hand. And so Mark had to make a decision as he sat in the pounding surf, shivering and shaking violently. How badly did he want to become an operator? What was it worth to him? I decided that I would keep going until I died, he told me in the interview. And then it got a whole lot easier. Am I dead yet? No? Then I can keep going. Many people think that finding answers to the right questions is the secret to setting and achieving goals. They're wrong. That's the easy part. The secret is facing the answers. How much pain are you willing to take? What are you willing to sacrifice? How far are you willing to go? And know this, it's always going to be harder than you think. It's always going to take more time, effort, and energy than you want to give. You're always going to face more seductions to stray than you think you can resist. And you're always going to suffer more setbacks and shocks than you feel is fair. If you can clear those hurdles, though, then there's quite literally nothing that can stop you except death itself. Recommended reading, 12 Rules for Life by Jordan B. Peterson. Do this now. The ability to sacrifice the present for the future is a skill you can practice. Like any other skill, the more you practice it, the better you get. And the better you get, the better you can do it in any area of your life. To start this process of improvement, take the following 7-day challenge. Each day will involve sacrificing something you probably find desirable and pleasurable for something that may not tickle the neurons, but will certainly toughen them. Day 1. Take a cold shower. Research shows that cold showers aren't going to help you lose fat faster, increase your testosterone levels, boost your post-workout recovery, strengthen your immune system, or give you prettier skin or hair. But they most definitely will do this. They'll make you really uncomfortable. And that's why they're a great way to kick off the challenge. Specifically, here's what you need to do. 1. Set your shower to its coldest setting and let it run for a couple of minutes, ensuring the water is as cold as possible. 2. Go in head first. Don't start with your toes and slowly work up your body. 3. Spend at least 3 minutes under the water, rotating every minute or so, ensuring your entire body is wet. 4. Optional. Reward yourself with hot water after the cold is complete. Or not, if you're willing to sacrifice that too. Day 2. No caffeine or refined sugar. Caffeine and sugar are two molecules that make the world go round, and that's why you're going to give them up for a day. And that means giving them up completely for 24 hours, not a single ounce of coffee or caffeinated tea or gram of refined sugar in any of its sneaky forms like sucrose, high fructose corn syrup, HFCS, evaporated cane juice, or dextrose. Day 3. Digital detox. The entire idea of detoxing the body through cleanses, teas, and supplements is outright quackery, but a regular digital detox through tech-free time can be well worth it. For instance, studies show that dialing down our use of devices can improve our sleep, make us less narcissistic, improve our mental health, and help us maintain a healthy relationship with our screened devices. The how here is simple. Absolutely no tech for 24 hours. No smartphone, tablet, computer, television, or anything else with a screen. This is easiest to do on a weekend day, of course, so feel free to start this 7-day challenge on a Thursday or Friday, or swap this day with another so it falls on a Saturday or Sunday. Day 4. No highly processed foods. You don't have to obsessively eat clean foods to be lean, muscular, and healthy. So long as you're getting the majority of your calories from nutritious, relatively unprocessed foods, you're doing it right. Unfortunately, however, most people don't do that and eat far too much low-quality, nutritionally bankrupt food instead. That's why today's challenge is to eat well for 24 hours. Practically speaking, that means sticking to simple, healthy foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes, and lean proteins. Foods that you have to prepare and cook yourself. If you want to make this as easy as possible, you can follow one of the clean eating meal plans provided in the bonus material at www.workoutmotivationbook.com/bonus. Day 5. 1 hour of cardiovascular exercise. Cardiovascular exercise can benefit your health in many ways, even if you already do regular resistance training. It can also be extremely uncomfortable, and so on this day, you're going to do an hour of it. What kind you do is up to you, but here's the rub. It has to be hard. So, if you're very out of shape, maybe it's an hour of walking. And if you're very fit, maybe an hour of vigorous jogging. Happy trails! Day 6. Wake up earlier. If you read a bunch of personal transformation stories on websites like Quora or Reddit, you'll quickly notice that many of them involve waking up earlier. Why? A number of reasons. One, it allows you to trade dead time, where you're passive and biding your time, for alive time, where you're engaged with life and doing something meaningful. By going to bed and waking up earlier, you'll naturally spend less time doing things you feel you should do less of and gain more time for things that are important to you, like exercise, reading, goal setting, meditating, working, or journaling. Two, it allows you to experience the joy of quietude. The early morning hours are peaceful and calm with no kids or babies squawking, cars rumbling, or devices buzzing. Three, it allows you to appreciate the beauty of the sunrise. Every day, nature greets us with a stunning vista of blues, reds, oranges, and purples. Missing it is a shame. Four, it allows you to be more productive. Even if you're not a morning person, you can become one, and when you do, you'll get more productive work done every day, period. By doing your most important work first thing before the distractions of the office and life kick into high gear, you might be surprised at just how much progress you can make on your most meaningful projects. So, on this wonderful day, wake up 90 minutes earlier than usual. This should be easier than an hour or even 30 minutes earlier due to your body's natural sleep rhythms. And then, use that time wisely. A few tips for succeeding in this challenge. 1. Go to bed 2 hours earlier than usual. The idea here isn't to sleep deprive yourself for a day, but to experience the benefits of both waking up early and being well rested. 2. Put your alarm clock far from your bed. You snooze and you lose. By forcing yourself to get up to turn off the alarm, you'll be up. 3. Leave the bedroom after turning off your alarm. Whatever you do, don't let your brain trick you into going back to bed. Force yourself out of the bedroom. Day 7. Leaving the shallows. Attention spans may not be dwindling as quickly as many people believe, but there's no question that we often have an overwhelming number of internal and external stimuli vying for our attention. This has heightened many people's desire for distraction, and research shows that the more our brains become accustomed to on-demand diversion, the harder it is to sweep aside and concentrate. To quote Cal Newport in his stimulating 2016 book Deep Work, The use of a distracting service does not by itself reduce your brain's ability to focus. It's instead the constant switching from low stimuli, high value activities to high stimuli, low value activities at the slightest hint of boredom or cognitive challenge that teaches your mind to never tolerate an absence of novelty. It's also self-evident that our ability to get on in the world is going to depend greatly upon our ability to manage our attention, who we become, what we learn and accomplish, and who's with us in the end will ensue directly from the things we pay the most attention to day after day and year after year. This is why Newport says that we should train our ability to concentrate intensely and overcome our desire for distraction. And that's the purpose of this challenge, which will have you do a bit of productive meditation. Specifically, I want you to take a period in which you're occupied physically but not mentally, like walking, jogging, or showering, and focus your attention on a single well-defined issue, opportunity, or problem. This could be a professional concern, like outlining an article, crafting a marketing plan, or sharpening a business strategy. A personal affair, like having a difficult talk with a partner, creating a new diet or exercise program, or figuring out how to save more money, or anything else that would improve your life if completed or resolved. Whatever you've chosen, your goal in this challenge is to concentrate solely on it for at least 15 minutes, up to as long as you can, and bring it closer to completion or resolution. You're probably going to struggle at first. Your attention is probably going to dart, wander, and stall, and that's okay. When this happens, gently remind yourself that you can think about whatever comes to mind later, bring your attention back to the issue at hand, and carry on. Look out for what Newport calls looping as well, where your mind loops over and over again on something you've already considered or realized instead of diving deeper and generating new ideas. When you notice this happening, acknowledge that you seem to be in a loop and then focus on the next new step in the process. Chapter 3: The Trouble with Waiting for Perfect. The way of the samurai is in desperateness. 10 men or more cannot kill such a man. Common sense will not accomplish great things. Simply become insane and desperate. Lord Naushidge. Think of something in your life you'd like to improve. Just one thing you'd like to add, change, or remove. Got it? Good. Now think of a few ideas of how you might move that needle. If you'd like to have more money, what are a few ways you could make some extra cash? Get creative. Want some help? Sell your skills on sites like TaskRabbit and Thumbtack. Learn to code web pages and offer your services to local businesses. Rent out a room in your house. Teach stuff you know on sites like Udemy or Skillshare. Become a field agent and help businesses do market research. Make cool stuff and sell it on Etsy. Deliver people's groceries with Instacart. Walk people's dogs. Or maybe you'd like to lose some fat and build some muscle? Okay, let's brainstorm. Make a proper meal plan. Eat no fast food for a month. Learn how to use portion control to your advantage. Stop buying foods you tend to overeat. Lift heavy weights a few times per week. Do a few high-intensity interval cardio workouts per week. Go for a long walk every morning. Or maybe you'd like to save more money, read more books, or learn a new skill? Go ahead and make the list. I'll wait. My point is, no matter what you'd like to change in your life, it's easy to compile a lengthy list of feasible ways to do it. The real question is why you're not doing any of those things. Why haven't you started? What are you waiting for? For the perfect moment? The perfect mood? The perfect day for all of your imaginary ducks to get in a row? Let's face it, conditions will never be just right. Perfect is just an excuse that we use to stay comfortable and ensconced in the status quo. When someone says they're going to do that one thing one of these days, we all know the truth. If they haven't carved out the time and energy already, they probably never will. They'll keep dreaming instead of doing until eventually they can't even bring themselves to dream anymore. Napoleon Bonaparte once said, "Sometimes death only comes from a lack of energy." Well, the surest way to suffer from a lack of energy is having a lack of ideas and challenges, from shouldering less burden than we can carry. In this way, waiting for perfect is a perfect way to die a little every day. The only choice, then, is to stop telling ourselves that we need things to be just right before we can start doing the thing. It'll never happen. Start now and figure it out as you go. You can sit around and wait for the inspiration to run a marathon, or you can get up right now and go for a 10-minute jog. You can wait for the stars to align before starting that side hustle, or you can skip Netflix tonight and start reading on where to begin. If you do this, if you can cast aside your fears, doubts, and anxieties and just get into action instead, you'll begin a process far more profound than you probably realize. You'll find that the more you do, the more your attitudes and feelings will shift. Limiting opinions and rationalizations that were once dear to you will crumble and fade away. Behaviors that first felt alien and formidable will become familiar and routine. In time, you'll become the rare type of person who is actually doing the thing. Elon Musk personifies this notion of acting boldly in the face of highly incomplete and imperfect information and circumstances. Take the origin story of SpaceX, for instance, a company whose stated purpose is to revolutionize space travel and help humans colonize Mars by the end of this century. For a long time, Elon told hedge fund giant Ray Dalio, "I've thought that it's inevitable that something bad is going to happen on a planetary scale, a plague, a meteor, that will require humanity to start over somewhere else, like Mars. One day, I went to the NASA website to see what progress they were making on their Mars program, and I realized that they weren't even thinking about going there anytime soon. I had gotten $180 million when my partners and I sold PayPal," he continued, "and it occurred to me that if I spent $90 million and used it to acquire some ICBMs from the former USSR and sent one to Mars, I could inspire the exploration of Mars." When Ray asked him about his background in rocketry, he told him he didn't have one. "I just started reading books," he said. And in fact, this venturesome spirit is the only way to be like Elon. Many people mistakenly believe, or want to believe, that you first have to change your mind before you can change anything else, that you have to find your balance before you can run. Research conducted by scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee suggests that this is exactly backward, that the surest way to change attitude is to change behavior, and that the reverse rarely works. You might think you need to wait for balance before running, but it's in the running itself that you usually find it. The reason for this is we derive our attitudes from how we behave and figure out who we are by watching what we do. Therefore, when we act in a way that's inconsistent with our current attitudes and beliefs, regardless of why, we will generally adjust the subjective to match the objective, not the other way around. In other words, we'll adjust our mental models to make sense of our behaviors, even if they're deceptive, disgraceful, or downright dreadful. In this way, every single thing we do every day molds and determines our self-definition to one degree or another. We can think all the best thoughts with all the right intentions, but unless our actions embody them, we'll reinterpret it all to rationalize our shortcomings. And the more intelligent we are, the better we're going to be at making excuses, creating a powerful, self-reinforcing, vicious cycle of degradation. Many people say many of the obstacles we face in life are of our own creation, the limitations, restrictions, and criticisms we impose on ourselves. This is probably true. It's also true, though, that the only way to clear these hurdles is through our willingness and ability to take action regardless of how we feel at first blush, and then to resist temptations to lose psychological ground by acting otherwise. How well we can do that, and that alone, will ultimately determine our fate more than anything else. In Alice in Wonderland, the Red Queen says that in her race, you have to run as fast as you can just to stay in place, and twice as fast as that to go anywhere. This is a perfect metaphor for life. You have to hustle just to pass muster, and work twice as hard as that to gain ground. I open this chapter with a quote from the legendary samurai general Lord Naoshij, whose story and sayings are found in the timeless book Hagakure. "The way of the samurai is in desperateness. 10 men or more cannot kill such a man. Common sense will not accomplish great things. Simply become insane and desperate." I believe his words are just as true today as they were 400 years ago, if not more so. Modern common sense says you shouldn't work too hard, that you shouldn't become too obsessed with a goal, that you should release yourself from the burdens of desire and pursuit, and just be thankful for what you have. These philosophies are quickly embraced by the more well-adjusted members of society. To these people, you must be insane if you're going to make it. Insane to work twice as hard as everyone you know. Insane to wake up at the crack of dawn to get in your workouts. Insane to pursue goals they don't understand and take risks they can't imagine. Many of these people will delight in telling you as much too. In fact, they'll have so much advice that if you were to scribble it all down on pieces of paper, you'd single-handedly decimate entire swaths of the world's forests. Always keep your eyes and ears open, but don't let their moonshine move you off target. "You shouldn't do that," they'll say, wheeling out a litany of reasons why it's not going to work out, why you should squander your life like they do, and why you'll regret it if you keep going. And then you'll say, "Screw it, I'm doing it anyway. Screw it, I'm going to count my calories and lose those 20 pounds. Screw it, I'm going to follow that workout program for a couple months. Screw it, I'm going to clean up my diet." You'll probably be afraid too, anxious, uncertain. All that is normal. Remember the first time you rode a bike? This is no different. All you have to do is shrug, mutter, "Who gives a shit," and get to work. You put in work and you get better. You get better and you gain confidence. You gain confidence and you want to do more good work. It's a virtuous cycle. The hobgoblins of fear and doubt will always hop around in your mind, sometimes more noisily than others, and that's okay. Some of it is even good. It keeps you moving, doing, working. It reminds you that the best way out is the way through. I dance with these boogeymen every time I start in on something new. "What if everyone hates it?" one might chirp. "What if you can't pull it off?" another might chime in. "What if it blows up in your face?" another might squawk. This is how I know I'm on the right path, that I've identified a challenge worth pursuing. If I'm not facing a new insecurity, then I know I'm not stretching far enough. Insane isn't enough, according to Lord Naoshij. You have to be desperate too. What's desperation? Napoleon Bonaparte said that death is nothing, but to live defeated is to die every day. That's desperation. It's the feeling that you must not be beaten, that everything is on the line, that only an all-in commitment is appropriate, and that the only excuse for failure is simply a failure of will. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness, said the mountaineer and writer W.H. Murray. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favor all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would have come his way. I have learned a deep respect for one of Goethe's couplets. Whatever you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. Years ago, I would have dismissed this as mysticism or myth. I've now experienced it enough to be fully convinced of the phenomenon. The more determined I am to see something through to a full and proper conclusion, the more it goes right, and often in ways that you can only chalk up to serendipity, unlikely opportunities, timely coincidences, and lucky lifelines. For whatever reason, intention seems to be a force multiplier of sorts, and work done with resolve seems to outpace work done with a wavering mind. I can clearly remember the watershed moment where I decided to go for broke as a fitness author and entrepreneur, despite initially rejecting the idea. I balked at first because as much as I love health, fitness, and helping others, I really don't love the health and fitness community and culture, which is overrun with liars, narcissists, and neurotics. Not exactly my scene. Furthermore, I only had one self-published book that was achieving moderate success, but no real following, friends, or even allies in the space, which is notoriously competitive and unreceptive to upstarts trying to make their bones. I considered all of this carefully, but chose to make the leap of faith anyway for four reasons. One, I was merely a competent writer, but that was enough to produce books and articles considerably better than most others in the space, and I knew I could vastly improve in this regard and gain even more ground. Two, many of the people who would be my competitors were lazy, complacent, and disorganized by my standards, and I was certain I could outwork and out-marshal them by an order of magnitude. Three, many of these people were also poor business people and marketers, and I was fairly certain I could outmaneuver them in those areas as well. Four, I had recruited a good friend of mine to work with me who is highly intelligent and hardworking, and I had faith that together we could pull off a win. My deliberation ended with a hard-line decision. I was going to do whatever it took to capitalize on this opportunity and make a splash in the fitness space. And it has been a rocket ride. Sure, my team and I have made plenty of missteps and suffered some painful blows, but we've also made enough astute judgments and strategic moves, spent enough time at the coalface, and gotten enough lucky breaks to establish a multifaceted, multi-million-dollar conglomerate of companies. So that's me. What about you? What would you like to make happen? Well, what are you waiting for? The clock is ticking. To quote from the Hagakure again, death seems a long way off. Is this not shallow thinking? It is worthless and is only a joke within a dream. Insofar as death is always at one's door, one should make sufficient effort and act quickly. It's time to decide. Are you insane and desperate enough to do what needs to be done? Recommended reading, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck by Mark Manson. Do this now. In his blockbuster book on productivity, Getting Things Done, David Allen shares a simple system for capturing what has our attention, clarifying what each item means and what to do about it, and organizing and optimizing our efforts. A major component of his GTD philosophy is breaking complex, overwhelming tasks into small, manageable tasks, and then starting on the first one. One of the exercises Allen recommends is taking the things that have our attention, concerns, worries, problems, issues, tensions, and translating them into achievable outcomes, projects, to be executed with concrete next actions. Let's get a taste of this. Write down the three things that are most on your mind these days. Don't exclude something because you think it might be irrelevant. If it's on your mind a lot, there's a reason, so it's probably a good idea to tackle it now rather than later. Many of us hold ourselves back from imagining a desired outcome unless someone can show us how to get there, Allen says in the book. Unfortunately, that's backward in terms of how our minds work to generate and recognize solutions and methods. There is a simple but profound principle that emerges from understanding the way your perceptive filters work. You won't see how to do it until you see yourself doing it. You often need to make it up in your mind before you can make it happen in your life. Next, then, visualize and write down the exact outcomes you desire for these affairs. For instance, how might your body look and feel if your diet and exercise regimens were to work out? How might that work project look if it were done well? How might your relationship with your significant other feel if the conversation you need to have went well? Whatever your three to-be-addressed things are, envision what success will ultimately look like for each and write it all down. Now it's time to brainstorm ideas as to how you might move toward those desired outcomes. What could you do to go from where you are to at least slightly closer to where you want to be? Don't judge, challenge, or evaluate these ideas yet. Just let them flow and write them down. Go for quantity here, not quality. Next, let's drill down to next actions, which Allen defines as physical, visible activities that would be required to move the situation toward closure. For example, throwing away all the junk food you tend to overeat so you can better stick to your diet. Calling three local gyms to get information on their classes. And buying an inexpensive upright bike so you can easily do cardio at home would all be good next actions. Formulate one single next action for each of your three concerns that would, once completed, bring you one step closer to the desired results, and write them down. Also, if any of these projects, as Allen would call them, have multiple components or aspects, feel free to generate a single next action for each of the moving parts. Allow me to provide a personal example of this exercise. 1. Write down the three things that are most on your mind these days. A. Completing the rather long lineup of important work projects on my plate, including finishing and launching this book, updating Bigger Leaner Stronger and Thinner Leaner Stronger, closing my first traditional book deal, getting more publicity, launching my first 4 Muscle for Life digital courses, and scaling up Legion's advertising. B. Improving the quality of my sleep, as it has gotten worse over the last few years. I wake up at least once or twice most nights, whereas I used to sleep straight through. C. Improving the quality of the time I spend with my wife and kids, as I feel I'm often not making it maximally rewarding to all. 2. Visualize and write down the exact outcomes you desire for these affairs. A. The timely and successful completion of the projects that have the greatest potential to impact the growth of my companies and brands. B. Regular, uninterrupted, and restful sleep. C. Regular, highly positive, and satisfying experiences with my family that foster joy, love, and intimacy for all 4 of us. 3. Now it's time to brainstorm ideas as to how you might move toward those desired outcomes. A. Clearly prioritize projects based on estimated time, difficulty, and payoff. Create a comprehensive action plan for the highest priority project. Track and assess everything I'm currently spending time on to see what can be delegated or eliminated to free up time for more important things. Roadmap the action plan into my work schedule to determine how quickly it could get done, and repeat the planning and scheduling process for any other tasks and projects that must be done concurrently. B. I've already tried quite a few things to improve my sleep with spotty results, but I'm homing in on the problem, which is twofold. One, I'm a lighter sleeper than I was years ago. Two, I'm more sensitive to caffeine as well. Therefore, I've stopped playing white noise when I sleep and limited my caffeine intake to about 120 milligrams on the weekdays and none on the weekends, and this has helped tremendously. The problem isn't 100% resolved, though, and completely eliminating caffeine for a week didn't make any difference. So next, I could create a relaxing pre-bed routine that could include things proven to help activate the parasympathetic nervous system, like taking a hot bath, doing a